Hi, I'm Juniper Eastwood. I ran cross country and track for the University of Montana, and running for me is a means to community.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to Triple Knot, a podcast for collegiate runners to share their stories, celebrate accomplishments, and open up conversations around the challenges we may face as young athletes. Today's guest is Juniper Eastwood, who is the first transgender Division I runner, and I've really been looking forward to talking to Juniper as she has an incredible story of living out her truth despite the unknowns and controversy that surround sexual and gender minorities competing in an environment that is so fixated on bodies and very set in some outdated ideas around what physical merit means. So without further ado, let's lace up with Juniper. So welcome to the show, and can you set us up with a scene of where you are and what's currently going on in your life?
Yeah, I guess I'm still in Missoula. A little strange, I guess. Normally, I would still technically probably be in season. A similar sentiment I'm sure a lot of people are sharing right now. And in a weird way, like, now I'm just, like, working at a coffee shop as a barista. I've been running on trails, sort of moving towards more of a trail running direction. And yeah, I think that's about it. Sort of gearing up for a graduate program and excited to start doing that. Been reading a lot.
Awesome. I've been trying to take advantage of some downtime to catch up on all the books that I want to read and just explore different areas of my life that I haven't really had a chance to yet. So how did running come into your life, and what are some of your first memories of falling in love with the sport?
I think running sort of came into my life sort of in a similar way that it comes into a lot of other people's lives. Like, I played different sports before middle school. Like, I played soccer and I played baseball actually for like 9 years. And I was always good at the running part of it. And my parents were both runners in high school, and I had a lot of family that had ran. And I guess, like, in middle school, I was like, oh, well, I guess my parents were good at this. Maybe I might as well try it. And honestly, I don't know that I would say I loved it at first, besides like the fact that I was maybe like, I had some amount of success at it that I didn't have as easily in other sports. So maybe it was like the ease of entry for me that sort of brought me in. And then I would say when I first started to love it was probably more in high school. Once I was sort of, it was more becoming sort of a lifestyle rather than just like the sport that I did. And I remember like starting to train during the summers. And I think that it becoming sort of a year round thing that I did was sort of what led me to sort of a deeper experience with it and really sort of loving it.
So when you were growing up and coming into yourself as a runner, how did you perceive yourself within the environment you were surrounded by, specifically in terms of your gender identity?
So I guess what sort of uniquely when I first started running, like in middle school on a cross country team and on a track team, I was also sort of coming to the awareness that I was different, and that, you know, I was, you know, born in, it's such a cliche, but like born in the wrong body. And I sort of came into like an awareness of both things at once, that I was this person that who ran and a person who was, you know, a transgender person. And they sort of seemed like I couldn't have both, if that makes sense. In middle school, it was like, well, it's one or the other. Like, I lived in like semi-rural Montana. And for me, it felt like you wouldn't be able to be both a transgender person in a small rural town and also like a sport, like an athlete. And yeah, I guess I understood who I was, but I sort of hid that for, well, both like protecting myself and to be able to run and to play these sports that I loved.
Yeah, that sounds really challenging, especially because running is such a place of discovering who you are and is such an outlet for whatever else you're feeling or whatever else is going on in your life. But then if you aren't really in a place where both can safely occupy the same space, it definitely creates this tension and sort of imbalance between outlet and identity. So yeah, I'm wondering, how would you describe yourself as a runner and person in high school preparing to go off into college? Like, what were some of your accomplishments? How into running were you, et cetera?
I think like a lot of runners, like that was essentially my entire identity in high school. Like, I actually don't think there was basically anybody else in my high school who actually enjoyed running. So I was like that one weird person who runs and can't stop talking about running, and everybody would see me like, oh yeah, that's that person who runs all the time. I think I would also probably describe myself as like distant, if that makes sense. Like, I sort of portrayed, I was just a runner. So for everybody else, that's like all I would talk about. And sometimes it would come off and maybe a little arrogant or like a little like full of myself, if that makes sense, because it was sort of, there's like this dual reality that I was living where like I knew who I was as a person and I was having to hide that. But at the same time, I was this runner and I was existing as this runner in high school. And sort of as like a protection of some sort, I would either say things that people wouldn't want to talk to me or wouldn't want to be friends with me, or I just wouldn't say anything at all. Yeah, I think I would describe myself as sort of distant. And I think the people I was around in high school, my high school friends, I think that they would sort of say the same thing. I've talked to a few of them and about it, and they've sort of said that like there seemed like there was something else sort of there that I wasn't sort of sharing. So it wasn't that like I was completely hiding it. Like, they could tell that I was hiding something, but they sort of just left it to me to tell them whenever the time came, I guess.
Yeah, and we grow up in such a cisgendered, binary, heteronormative, whatever other pins you want to put on it, culture. And I don't think that most of society understands how damaging those norms are to people's self-perception, especially when you're going through adolescence and trying to make sense of where you fit in, or I guess don't fit in. And it must be so hard right now too for the people who lean on running as their primary source of identity but can't have that right now because of the pandemic. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I can add sort of like the girl, I dated a girl for like a year and a half while I was in high school. And little did I know that everybody around me, or that I wasn't as good at hiding these things as I thought I was, if this makes sense. Yeah. And everybody on my cross country team and all in my friend groups, they all thought that, well, that I was gay because I was sort of like outwardly feminine, even though I thought that I wasn't. And even this girl that I dated, she thought that I was, but somehow we still dated for a year and a half. Doesn't make a lot of sense. But I think people, I would say the people around you, the people who are your friends, a lot of times are more perceptive than they sort of let on. And like, even if you are trying to hide something, if you're around them and they know you, I think that they pick up on these things.
Was it something that you even could fully understand? Like, did you feel like it was even a foreseeable option to change your gender and go on hormone treatment or to express more of a feminine side? Or did it just seem like no way in hell was I going to get through high school like that?
Yeah, I guess sort of what I did was, even starting in middle school, like I would pick more like androgynous leaning options for dressing. Like, so it was like I knew there was an option. I watched and still watch a lot of transgender YouTubers. And I actually watched sort of the first person. Is uniquely when I was sort of coming to an awareness of myself as a transgender person, there was another person who was sort of the first person to document a transition on YouTube. And I didn't know this at the time, but I found her videos and I was probably 12 or 13 and I watched like all of them, and there's hundreds of them or like 150 of them or something like that. And I would just watch like every video that I could find on YouTube at the time about it. So it wasn't like I didn't know that that was an option. And I guess in the back of my mind was like, I kind of know that this is probably going to have to happen at some point, and eventually like I'm going to have to, this is going to come to a head, and I'm going to choose one or the other, if that makes sense. I guess in my mind, like in high school, I sort of dreamed of like being a professional athlete, and that was like my sole focus. And you know, you don't really think that, you don't really see any transgender professional athletes. You see very like heteronormative cisgendered athletes as sort of the norm. And you see people who are a little different, they get attacked. So it just makes you just, when you are living sort of this dual, as I was saying before, as you're living the sort of dual reality, you sort of end up choosing one. And in high school, I sort of chose that, the runner part of me over the other. And it wasn't until I was in college where I sort of realized you could have both.
Yeah, so even though sport was a source of passion and identity for you, it was also still not fully a space where you felt like you could be yourself, and you felt like you had to still mask a side of you, but maybe weren't aware of what that meant until college.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I guess I'll also share, I think a lot of it came down to like also just like my parents, and a lot of why I think I became sort of as successful a runner as I became was because of sort of parental pressure, if that makes sense. Like my dad always like expected a lot of me in all aspects of my life, like school and sports and all of that. And I mean, in some ways it was really positive, like to have that sort of pressure to like do your best and all that kind of stuff. But eventually, like, I guess my dad started writing all of my, all of my running plans. Mm-hmm. And like, my high school coaches didn't coach me essentially. Like they were basically, I was basically coached by my dad separate from everybody else. And I ran separate workouts from everybody else. And it was sort of a really, in a way, it's a super isolating experience, because, you know, you sort of go to practice, and for most people, you know, they go and they work out with their teammates and they enjoy that part of it. But it was sort of a really like solitary experience for me. So I had a lot of time to sort of think and be with myself, even during the season. And I think sort of the pressure from my dad, especially, and that carried into college, but that's where a lot of the, like, I need to be this like professional athlete, like I need to, you know, be my best. And ultimately, like, it did make me a really good runner. Like, I guess I respond to that sort of pressure. But it also, like, I think it caused a lot of stress in my life, for sure. And like, that's why I think I felt so like I needed to put things in a box, and just like dedicate myself to that and to make him happy.
Yeah, and you were a Montana state champion when you were in high school too. So you were a very high level runner, as you said, from the type of training and work ethic that you had. And it sounds a little bit like a shortcoming too on the on the part of high school coaches and role models. You know, they have that opportunity to be a really positive influence in people's lives and in people's adolescence when they're coming into their identity.
Yeah. Well, I guess I would say that, like, my coach, in a way, it was like a balancing act. Like, my dad sort of provided the training and the structure and, like, the pressure to succeed, if that makes sense. Like, a coach wasn't necessarily putting that on me, but what my coaches did provide me was, like, they were more, like, softer. They were softer people than my dad is. And my dad's not, like, he's not soft, if that makes sense. But I guess my coaches, they provided this, like, emotional aspect of it. And, like, they cared for the emotional part of me as an athlete in a way that, like, I wasn't getting from my dad. So in a way, like, those are sort of weird reversed roles, because a lot of times you would think, like, oh, these coaches are sort of providing the structure and the pressure to succeed, and your parents are providing that sort of emotional support of you as a person. And not to say that my dad didn't emotionally support me necessarily, but I think that what was super helpful for me, and even now, like, I still talk to one of my high school coaches for guidance, like, once a month or something like that. We call and we talk on the phone and all that kind of stuff. I think it was more like they helped me with, like, figuring out which direction my life was going. And then, like, also helping me sort of cope with some of the pressure that my dad was putting on me. I think sort of a good example of that was I won state cross country my senior year of high school, and because I didn't run the time that my dad had wanted me to run on this course on the specific day, it was really soggy, so it was sort of like a course condition thing also affected it. He was, like, not as fully excited for me. Like, he was like, yeah, a little disappointed, even though I had won the state meet. And he, like, had held this, like, idea of going to Foot Locker over my head during the state meet. And because I didn't run that time, we didn't go. So it was, like, yeah, sort of, like, a weird relationship and a weird pressure. And, like, especially during, like, indoor track season when, I mean, most Montana student-athletes, they don't have an indoor track season during high school. But I did, because we would drive out of state to attend track meets in, like, Idaho and Colorado and all sorts of other places. And I spent a lot of time with my dad during the winter training.
Yeah, so you did have that emotional support system from your high school coach, but at the end of the day, your parents are who you go home to. And I guess if you're constantly getting that message of needing to be better, things aren't good enough, it's going to be really draining.
Yeah, for sure. I think it took off a lot of my energy and made it more difficult to sort of share things with him. Mm-hmm. As, like, he was basically, I sort of started to think of him more as, like, coach than as dad at times.
Yeah, and I'm sure there was a fear around losing the runner part of yourself too, as you spoke to with.
Yeah.
So how did you end up choosing to continue your student athlete life at the University of Montana?
I guess I sort of knew from the time I was probably, like, a sophomore in high school that I wanted to be a collegiate runner somewhere. And I guess I had dreams of going bigger places, like a lot of people, I'm sure. And I guess I emailed those places, and places like Colorado or even NAU or Oregon. And the responses I got back were mostly like, hey, like, you can be a preferred walk-on. Like, we'd love to have you on the team. But if you want, like, scholarship, these are the times you have to run. And I was, like, just off all of them. Like, I had ran, yeah, maybe a second slow in the 800 or, like, 3 or 4 seconds slow in the mile. So, like, just off of the money. And, like, I probably, had I gone to those schools, I probably would have eventually maybe got some money. But in my mind, like, everybody's telling me, like, oh, like, you need an athletic scholarship. Like, college is really expensive. And because of that, I was actually sort of dead set on going to the school that is the rival of the school I went to. It's at Montana State. And I actually was wearing, like, Montana State stuff, like, in my cross country, my state cross country, like, pictures with my team and everything. And I went on a visit a month later here at the University of Montana, and I really liked the coach, and I really liked Missoula. It's a really beautiful place, and it has just amazing access. I was just sort of amazed by how close a lot of the trail, like running trails, are here, and I didn't have to drive to them like I did in Bozeman and Belgrade. And I sort of had a discussion with a friend when I came back home after my visit, and I was like, well, I don't know, like, MSU seems pretty good, like, I like the team, I like the coach there too. But yeah, MSU was only 8 miles from my parents' house, so it would basically be like staying home. And my friend was like, I really think, well, she had gone to Oklahoma State for like a veterinary school, and we sat down and had this conversation, and she goes, yeah, I really think you need to sort of get out of Belgrade to be able to sort of figure out who you are, and you're going to grow as a person more if you decide to go elsewhere. So I think it was probably the day after that that I called the coach here and was like, hey, like, I'm verbally committing, like, I'm going to be a Grizz. I sort of really got sold on the idea of sort of running for my home state, because that was sort of the ethos of the coach at the time. He was like, I want to build a team, like a really strong team from runners from Montana, because we have strong runners, but we keep losing them out of state. Runners like, well, and the fact that McKenna Morley had decided to go to the University of Montana as well. And I'm like, well, I mean, if she thinks it's a good school, good enough school for her, then it might as well be a good enough school for me. She's, you know, like a national caliber athlete. And yeah, I guess I got really sold on the idea of a Montana dynasty, if that makes sense. And yeah, I think that's sort of how that decision came about.
That's awesome that you had those high-level prospects, like the big names you mentioned, like Colorado, Oregon. But yeah, Montana, I've never been to Montana, but I did have a friend from Bozeman, and it seems like such a beautiful, incredible place to run and to live. And yeah, that's really, it's a really neat atmosphere to be able to try to build your reputation as runners within the state. So how did you adjust to life as a college student athlete when you arrived at Montana, at the University of Montana? What challenges initially came up for you?
Yeah, I guess when I first came to school, I was an athlete student. That makes sense. I came to run. I didn't come to be a college student. Yeah, my major was health and human performance, which is sort of the athlete major. And I had all the same classes actually the exact same class schedule as McKenna Morley, who had also come in as an athlete student. She was also majoring in health and human performance. And I struggled sort of through the first season I had in college, and didn't have a lot of, like, I didn't have the success that I thought I would have immediately. I guess the adjustment sort of away from home and away from sort of my dad's coaching was more difficult than I thought it was going to be. And school wasn't challenging, so I had a lot of free time. And I sort of struggled. I actually really struggled to make friends my freshman year. I guess, like, my only friend that first semester of college, like, only really good friend was McKenna, actually, since we were in class together all the time, and, you know, we would eat together at the food zoos, the dining hall here. And I eventually, you know, I made other friends on the team. I made a really good friend, Carson, who eventually I ended up living with. But I had a lot of free time when I wasn't running, because I didn't really need to study because my classes were really easy. And I guess I just listened to music like 8 to 10 hours a day or something like that. Listened to like the 500 greatest albums of all time as ranked by Rolling Stone from 500 to number one, because I just had that much free time.
That's funny. And McKenna Morley, she ended up transferring to Colorado and she turned pro, right?
Yeah, she just did. And she transferred, well, after that first semester. So I guess I had to find other friends after that. Just like issues with that coach for her, and also just like sort of needing to have somebody to train with. Like, there weren't at the time, like, she was at such a level that like she would run with the boys because there wasn't any girls to sort of run with her. It's not like the other girls on the team were bad. It was just like she was far and above like anybody, even in the conference. Like, she didn't have any competition even when we went to the conference meet. Like, she went and ran her own race like 45 seconds in front of everybody else. So I think that decision was really good for her to sort of get into a bigger program with girls that would challenge her. And I think ultimately that's what led to her being successful in Colorado.
So yeah, you were in some good company there, but maybe building the Montana dynasty wasn't exactly coming to fruition.
Yeah, no, I don't think there was any sort of Montana dynasty. And I guess there used to be, like, in the 90s, the team was sort of nationally ranked all the time. And even before that, they were really good. But like starting even in the 2000s, it was just sort of more downhill from there. Like, not necessarily downhill, like, we're sort of a middling team at the conference level with, hopefully it'll get better. Like, we have a new coach. The team has a new coach this year, this last year, and I think things will start moving in a positive direction with his guidance.
So, as you proceeded through your college years, what challenges came up for you as a runner, and when did you start grappling more with your identity outside of sport?
I sort of said that I had not a lot of success my first semester of college. Actually found out that cross country is always a little bit of a sticking point for me. In the spring, when I had quite a bit more success on the track in the sort of the 1500, had a really good outdoor track season and was so super fired up going into my sophomore cross country season, which I did actually end up having the success that I wanted my freshman year during that sophomore season. But I think sort of my ambitions got ahead of me in a way. Like, I just kept pushing mileage. I was like, well, I need to be hitting, 100 plus mile weeks so that I can run these times and I can keep up with the rest of these people in our conference and be competitive and all of that. And if I want to be a pro runner someday, like, I need to be able to handle this kind of mileage anyways. So after season, we took a couple of weeks off, but when I was sort of getting back into it, I jumped in a little too quickly and I ended up getting super injured. I had like a super bad IT band injury where like I could probably run like half a mile, but eventually I would be in so much pain that I would just like have to stop and cry and then end up walking back home. So I was actually out for like close to 2.5 months, which for me, that was the longest that I had been out of running since like middle school. And running was sort of always the way to sort of cope with the other things. When things got hard with on the identity side of things, like, I would just train harder. And I guess what ended up happening was I got really depressed because I didn't have the running to cope with the other things. And I turned to other things, like, I guess I started drinking a lot, got really depressed, was having a lot of like not super happy thoughts, like suicidal thoughts. And eventually I was in such a desperate state that I told one of my closest friends, I was like, hey, like, this is what's going on. And that was probably early February of my sophomore year of college, which would have been 2017. And I came out, and then I came out to sort of my group of friends. That these friends were like, they weren't on the team. They were off the team because I had had a teammate actually tell me that because this is college athletics, like we don't need to be friends with their teammates. And, you know, you need to be able to find friends who aren't on the team, which was like, yeah, not necessarily the like happiest thing I had heard from a teammate who was, you know, friends with other teammates. So I mean, eventually I did. I found teammates within sort of my major. They were, all of these friends were also women's studies. And I had changed to women's studies like right after my first semester of college, because I realized that like the athlete major wasn't all I thought it was going to be. And, you know, maybe I'm in college and I might as well study something I want to study. Yeah, I had came out my freshman year as, you know, bisexual because I just needed some way to like be able to express that I was different. And that was sort of the easiest one, if that makes sense. It's like, well, I mean, this is probably the most acceptable one. I'm just going to throw that out there. This is me, I guess. And yeah, I sort of knew that the rest of it was sort of coming. I think that sort of opened this floodgate for like when I did get super depressed. Like I was already, you know, this not straight person. You might as well just like come out to my friends who weren't on the team and tell them sort of the full reality of it. Yeah, actually, my college coach at the time was actually the second person I told. I told her about all this stuff before I ever told my family or any other friends, my teammates. She was sort of looped in right away just because like of how much running mattered to me, that like I needed to know that like she knew what was going on with me. And because she was sort of like, in a way, she was sort of a nurturing figure. And we sort of had a relationship where I felt really open to sharing whatever was going on in my life. Well, and actually her college coach, not her college coach, her professional coach, because she ran professionally here in Missoula with the Mountain West Track Club with a bunch of other really sweetie women. And her coach actually transitioned, so it wasn't like she was unfamiliar with it. So I actually felt really comfortable with sort of sharing that information with her and knowing that she would respond sort of positively. Not necessarily positively, but supportively.
Yeah, that's great to have that person to turn to. Yeah, and I went through my own mental health challenges in college, and I totally understand how when running is your whole identity and your whole persona, and then that's taken away from you for injury or just poor performance, and you can no longer keep burning yourself into the ground as a runner, it becomes really hard to then grapple with who you are outside of the sport. And yeah, it's, oh my gosh, it's so like, it's really hard to hear how, like what you experienced in terms of feeling suicidal. And I think it's just really important to highlight that for trans people, that's the unfortunate reality, is disproportionate rates of suicide and mental illness. And no one should ever feel like they would be better off leaving the world closeted as society's idea of who they are than living as their authentic self. That's really heavy.
Yeah, no, it's definitely not an easy thing to talk about.
For sure. So thank you for sharing. How, so what was your actual process of transitioning? I know that you shirted your senior year to go through hormone therapy as per NCAA regulation. So what was like the next step for you after coming out to actually making the move to transition?
Yeah, I guess the conversation I had with my coach was like, hey, like this is what's going on, like, you know, I've came out to my friends and I'm having them refer to me this way, and this isn't going to affect my running. Like I'm going to keep running, and I'm going to, you know, I'll wait until after I'm done with college running to transition physically. And yeah, I was really depressed that spring track season. Like, I definitely remember doing workouts where, like, I was so depressed that I would sort of just, like, start crying while we were doing them. And I wasn't having a lot of success during that season, naturally. Like, you know, I was coming back from injury and I was dealing with this really heavy stuff. But I mean, in my personal life, like, I had this really supportive group of friends who were sort of referring to me the right way. I must have came out to a couple of my teammates who I sort of trusted at the time. And sort of the thought was, like, I'm going to make it through this experience of being a college athlete, and then I'll deal with the rest of it. So still sort of putting it off in a way, because I didn't want to have to deal with, you know, quitting or being a trans athlete. Because, I mean, at the time I did know that the rules existed, like, I had looked. And I knew that that was definitely a super hard route to choose at the time. And I guess eventually I ended up coming out to my teammates, like, in the fall of my junior season during cross country. Like, I just couldn't sort of keep it in anymore. Like, I was like, hey, like, this is who I am. Like, call me June or Juniper and use these pronouns. And I think people were sort of shocked a little bit. Like, they knew that I was, like, sort of depressed and was dealing with some emotional, mental stuff. But I think, quite a few of them were pretty shocked. And what it came down to was, I actually brought together the captains from both teams, both the women's team and the men's team, and sort of told them what I was going to tell the team and bounced it off of them. I had a letter written that I had shared. And it was a lot easier for me to just have them read that letter than it was for me to actually say it, at least to the team captains, because it was, like, a little more of an intimate setting. It was in a coffee shop in Missoula, and I'm sure to share that information. And they're like, wow, this is, like, really touching. Like, I'm sorry that you've been having to deal with this for so long quietly. And I told the team, just, like, flat out was like, hey, like, this is what's going on. Like, if you have any questions, like, come find me. And, you know, I actually had, like, an okay junior cross country season. And the thought was, like, at least now I'm, like, at least my teammates are treating me and seeing me for who I am. And they were great. They like, very positively responded and were so supportive immediately, sort of. And that was super helpful. But the thought was still, like, okay, like, I'm going to get through the outdoor season now, and I'm just going to quit. Like, I'm going to be done. And the head track coach and my distance coach both gave me the option. They're like, hey, like, if it gets too hard and, like, you can quit at any time, like, we're not going to hold it against you, any of that. And I was like, no, like, I'm not going to quit. And actually had, like, because I was able to sort of be out within my team, I actually had, like, that was actually probably my best outdoor track season that I had in college, was my junior track season. I ran PRs in both of my events, both the 5000 and the 1500, times that are probably comparably faster than I ran after I transitioned. And then after that season ended, or actually before the outdoor season started, I was like, hey, like, talked to my coaches and was like, hey, like, so there's these rules that say that transgender athletes can compete after a year on hormones. Like, what do you think about that? Just, like, sort of throwing it out there and seeing how they would respond. Like, I don't really want to give up this sort of extra 2 years of running that I could have, but I also know that, like, for my physical and mental well-being, like, I need to transition because it is just really unhealthy for me at this point to keep sort of having to put stuff in a box and not really be outwardly myself. And they're like, okay, yeah, let's meet with sort of the compliance person, let's sort of talk about this. And I guess I met with our NCAA compliance person and sort of worked with her in like navigating how that would look. And yeah, that's sort of how that got set in motion, I suppose.
Yeah, that's crazy too. Being the first of anything is a big deal. And there's like no guidelines, even the NCAA policies, there's really no sounding board for, like, I mean, I'm sure that they thought carefully about what policies they were making, but like when they haven't been implemented yet, you don't know what you're going into uncharted territory.
Yeah, I was sort of like a test dummy, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of like, I don't know, I guess I made the decision because I didn't want to regret not having done it like 5 or 10 years from now. Like, hey, I had that opportunity. I just thought that had I not stayed on the team for the 2 extra years that I had stayed on the team, that I would regret it, because not everybody gets the chance to be a Division I athlete, and it's sort of a unique experience that I didn't want to miss out on, if that makes sense.
For sure. And college is still like sort of your last go at being in that controlled, safer environment, at least in regards to the rest of the world. What was your college environment and on-campus support like? Where were you able to reach out for help or resources?
Yeah, I guess on campus here, specifically, I guess my support network came from a lot of like other women's studies people. I actually got it really involved with my, a lot of my friends were involved with, and I got involved with the Women's Resource Center on campus, which sort of allowed me to put into motion a lot of the things that I was learning in class, and to sort of help people. For me specifically, the support, it came from online. I think I looked at a lot of Reddit threads, and I guess I didn't post a lot on Reddit threads, but I sort of just would read other people's questions, and there was some support there. I didn't know a lot of like other trans people besides like a few trans men. There wasn't a lot of like immediately accessible trans women, if that makes sense. Like, it's not like everybody's, you know, has a sign on their head like, hey, like, I'm a trans woman, come talk to me.
Yeah.
In fact, I think it's quite the opposite. I think for the most part, like, trans women want to keep to themselves, and it's not something they want to talk about necessarily. So I think my support network came from, well, really supportive friends. That makes sense.
For sure. I think having that support within a closer circle too is really the most important thing. It seems really challenging to go through this transition and then also like have the running side of your identity taken away from you. So how did you stay involved in the sport and in your team? And what did you learn about yourself and how you balance all these sides of your identity in the year that you were going through the hormone, the year between competing while you went through the hormone treatment?
Yeah, so I guess how we worked it out was they listed me on the team, on the men's team still, but like on the inactive roster, which meant that I could still practice. And I guess I went to all of our practices. I practiced with the women's team starting that fall and was part of the team for, I mean, all aspects besides the competing aspect. And I would just, you know, I would do time trials and that kind of thing instead. So, like, honestly, it wasn't very much different than, like, just not being able to compete. It was, like, honestly, if I had redshirted an entire year, that's basically what happened. Yeah, and I guess that was a very different experience, just from being surrounded by men to being surrounded by women.
What was that? What was the year when you returned back to competition like for you? What was your first race like?
Yeah, I guess it was really nerve-wracking, just because I had sort of met with journalists beforehand who knew me, like who were friends of, like mutual friends, and they had published some stuff. So there was a lot of like online hype, I guess, about me, about like, oh, well, you know, she's going to come in and destroy everybody essentially. And I ended up getting like seventh or something like that. And it was sort of anticlimactic for people because they sort of assumed that I was going to come in and just immediately start destroying the sport, if that makes sense. So for me, it was like, there was a lot of pressure just because there was so much. I think that morning I was on Fox News, like the Fox News. So it was like, oh God, like the whole fucking world is watching me. Sorry, don't mean to cuss, but, and you know, like if I do well and that, like, people are gonna riot, you know, everybody online is gonna ask for my head. And that, so I guess there was, yeah, a lot of nerves going into it, but a lot of excitement too. Like I mean, I hadn't competed in 15 months. And that was the longest I had gone without competing since I was in middle school. So I was excited to get back to racing, but at the same time, really nervous for sort of what that meant and the change that my competing was going to bring.
It's so crazy. Just by virtue of being yourself, you're under all of media scrutiny.
Yeah.
Like, do you ever agree to interviews or agree to articles and then they come out and you're like, oh my gosh, like, why did they write it that way? Or like, how do these people get, cause there's ignorance, there's bad journalism, but then there's also just like blatant like fake news around your story and none of these people know you personally.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, I was really selective about who I let sort of tell my story, to the point that I even had a friend who was a journalist who wanted to tell my story, but I didn't let him tell my story because I didn't think that he was going to accurately represent it. And I think the interviews that I had agreed to, all of those interviews turned out really well. Like the one that was in Runner's World turned out well. There was a Dieset interview that I thought was really well written. The one that ended up in the Bozeman Chronicle from a mutual friend was really good. The little short film that they made was really good. It's the articles that like don't even ask like for my input. Those are the ones that usually end up sort of bad. Or when websites that already have sort of an agenda will copy paste from articles that were good just to like let the comment section speak for itself in a way. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That has been really challenging. Yeah, I haven't done a lot of interviews since like September. I might have done one, I think. I can't exactly remember, but I think the hype died down when I didn't immediately start just like winning by minutes.
Yeah, because it's like, I mean, as I was saying earlier, it's like erasing who you are and all the work that you put in. Like, you were fast before you transitioned. You were slower once you did transition because naturally that's what the hormones do to your body. But you still can be fast. Like, it's just, yeah.
Yeah.
It's
yeah, well, I also think it's sort of interesting because I was in a conference when I was on the men's side of the conference. I was running against NAU, which is, you know, like they have like 15 athletes who could show up on any day and just destroy everybody. and you take them out of the picture and my results are significantly elevated at the conference level. They're sort of an anomaly on the men's side of the Big Sky Conference, just because of how much better they are than everybody else in the conference. And I think people don't necessarily realize, like, I was on my team, I was like the best by like a minute at times. like during a cross country race, like I would finish and I would be a minute in front of the next person on my team who would finish, or I would be like 30 seconds ahead of them in a 5K or 45 seconds. So it wasn't like, it was a pretty isolating experience. And then when I got on the women's team, like, you know, I had teammates who were just as fast as me, if not faster. So it was like a really different experience because I was this standout on the other side. And now I'm like, yeah, I'm one of the top runners, but like there's also ones that are just as good, if not better at times.
Right. So your performances relative to how fast you were before transitioning are actually now slower or on par with where you were prior to transitioning. There was never a point where you were breaking world records, or like you've always been a good runner and you're still a good runner. It's as simple as that. And I've also seen the argument.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I've seen the backlash with people claiming that trans athletes are going to be the downfall of women's sports and that this is a women's rights issue or something ludicrous like that. And it's like, at a basic level, understand that if you actually want women's rights in sports, there's a lot of other ways that we should be getting up in arms and advocating for them, like equal pay issues, Title IX being under threat, maternity support, changes that will lead to actual opportunities and advancements that should include trans athletes and do not involve discriminating against trans athletes, you know?
Yeah. Well, yeah, attacking the, like, the five trans women who decide to compete.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Yep. It's just, like, yeah, I think the sort of dearth of for itself in a way. Like I can think of like six trans athletes off the top of my head that like there, I guess there's I can't think of that many. Like there's definitely not more than I can count on my hands. And they want to attack these like, you know, 10 people, 10, 15 people, as opposed to like the fact that there's like, you know, 90,000 or 150,000 other athletes. So it's like such a narrow percentage of the people who are actually competing that it doesn't make a lot of sense why there's so much energy being thrown into that. It's not like there's like 1,000 trans athletes. Like that would be a way different thing than like, I mean, really there's been one at the Division I level. And yeah, people were up in arms about it.
Yeah. And it's also like, to, I don't know, for me as a female who grew up as an athlete and graduated from college with a degree in engineering, like I'm grateful for those opportunities because of all the work that women before me did to get to that place. And like, I couldn't imagine my life without having those outlets and those parts of my identity. So it's like, can't we emphasize with how important it is for all people and trans people to have those same opportunities, same access, and be a part of that battle to, as allies, to fight for those rights.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so. Yeah. I guess what I would say is like, I think if a lot of these people actually met me and like sat down and had a conversation with me, I don't know that I would necessarily change their opinions, but they might be a little more endeared to my inclusion, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I just think that like it's really easy to say things when you're not saying them to a person, and when you haven't sort of met that person and had to sort of confront that head on and empathize with another person like you would in person.
Yeah, so what are some ways that people can actively support trans athletes, and what are some, like, just in the middle of this interview, you received some news, so can you talk about that and what some current, like, policies and mentalities that are restricting LGBTQ plus rights today are?
Yeah, I guess I would say a major thing to do would be to sort of think before you decide to just go to the comment section brigade and let the comment section inform your opinion. I think that would be a good start to like becoming a better ally. Is to sort of maybe reflect on it and or like learn about trans experiences or LGBT experiences from LGBT people. Like actually listening to them. Active listening is usually hard for people who are in comment sections online, but I think other ways would be sort of sharing stories like mine or like others, and showing support in that way. And then I guess the biggest one I sort of was thinking when I saw some of these questions was just to like be a friend to those people. Like if you have an LGBT friend that comes out to you and confides in you, just to support them. And as far as sports go, like I think 90% of the athletes that I competed against are a really good example of how you support people. Like they were nothing but like kind to me, and would go out of their way to be nice to me and, you know, talk to me and just make me feel included. And I think that sort of speaks for like, you know, you don't really need to beat down other women for your own betterment, if that makes sense. Like that's just something that really gets to me, is when other women feel like they need to knock other women down a peg to raise themselves up, when really like through supporting each other, we're all better for it. And yeah, I think, well, especially my experience this year, I think especially the NAU girls, who are very good as well as the men on that team, were really just a great example of this. Every time I saw them, they're like, oh, hey, like, how's it going? Like, how's training been? And we sort of were both really excited for each other's successes. And yeah, I just think that like there's this sort of idea that sports is to win a race, or like running is to win a race. Like that's the whole reason why we run. But I think for me, and I think for some of these other women, that's not really the case altogether. Like a lot of it is like the community that you get from it, and being able to support those other women and see them succeed. And I think for me, like that's definitely one of the most fulfilling part of it, like part of what I experienced this year competing, that I guess I didn't necessarily experience before.
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, just like as simple as you said, showing people love and showing people compassion, and small gestures like speaking to people, using the proper pronouns, introducing yourself with pronouns, educating yourself. What are some of the policies though that are limiting, like the Idaho bill that recently passed?
Yeah, I think that it's a concerted effort by a small group of women who feel very passionately about women's rights, but in sort of the wrong way, if that makes sense. Like they think that fighting for women's rights, again, like I was saying, like it means beating down, well, trans women specifically. And it just sort of follows that same path of like, oh, we need to beat down other women to raise ourselves up. And I mean, the history behind like a lot of feminist movements sort of looks the same. Like you have, you know, cis straight women in the early 60s beating down the lesbian women to raise themselves up and get their rights first. And it's like they're worried that two people can't fit through the door at the same time, if that makes sense. Like that by somebody like me having rights and like being supported, that they're going to have less rights in some way. And I just don't think that's true. And yeah, I think there's a lot of misinformation and sort of pseudoscience that goes behind a lot of these cases. Like when I was reading sort of the language behind the bill that passed in Idaho, it relies on a lot of studies that are sort of like notoriously known to like be sort of inaccurate or biased. And the people who were supporting the bill are also sort of notoriously known to be like biased, and it's not really based on any sound science or data. I mean, if they had even looked to my case and like realized that like for the vast majority of the races that I ran, I lost. Like, it wasn't like I was winning every race and I was like not, like I was beating everybody by like a minute and a half every time. And, you know, I was destroying the sport or anything like that. It was, it was very different than that. And I think that like, there's sort of a disconnect from reality. Like there's this fear mongering that goes on. We're like, oh, this could happen. This could happen. We need to like put the strictest legislation up so that this doesn't happen. And so that, you know, we don't have to, well, in reality, like the grand scheme of things is like, yeah, our society doesn't really like trans people.
I remember too, in the recent Olympics, the controversy around the 800 meter with, I think there were three intersex athletes that were competing at the top of their game, like Caster Semenya. And that too, it's just like, it's also has a racial and component to it as well. It's just like, again, imposing Western standards of femininity and beauty like on black bodies. And it's like men are always praised for their physical prowess and uniqueness, but then it's the women who are attacked and questioned and humiliated. So it's really the patriarchy and white supremacy we should be questioning here.
No, and I would agree. Like I guess my girlfriend and I, we talked a lot about the Caster Semenya case, and just that like a lot of what they were attacking wasn't the fact that like Caster was a successful athlete. It was because she doesn't really present like in Western feminine ways, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And I just think it's sort of a double standard, because realistically, like the person who has the world record in the 800, I mean, if you've seen pictures of her, like she was a white woman who was also very muscular, looked sort of masculine, and was, you know, East German. So there's sort of some controversy around that. And like they didn't attack her in the same way that Caster has been attacked.
Yeah. Yep. I know it's crazy. And I hope people take a second to reflect on that and like look at who is actually under scrutiny and realize where it's coming from. And it's really coming from preserving the power at the top of these like structures that are based off of white people and based off of men succeeding.
Well, and I think that like the backlash against me and other trans athletes, I think it comes from a broader backlash against progress. Just like, yeah, with any progress, I think eventually those who benefit from upholding sort of tradition and the status quo will eventually sort of question it and try to beat it down, and usually not in the most positive ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. So let's talk a little bit more about you as a runner before we wrap things up here. So during college, what have been some of your favorite memories and maybe proudest moments in racing and training?
I think that some of my proudest moments, getting through both my junior cross country and track seasons, and like actually somehow that being not a wholly negative experience, like I can definitely take positives from it. That's been a really positive experience. I think that getting to become a better teammate is probably my favorite part of this whole experiment of mine, I guess. And I think that having to be so patient and compassionate with people made me a better listener and, you know, a better teammate and a better runner for it. And I think that, like, what changed from high school and even early college to my junior and senior and fifth year was that, like, the sport became more about, like, community and team than it was, you know, like a solitary experience. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm proud of the fact that I built close relationships with a lot of the women on my team. And now, like, a few of those women are some of my closest friends. And I think for me, like, those relationships are what I'm most proud of.
So how has COVID-19 been affecting you? I know that went through this whole process of coming out and transitioning, and then, you know, suddenly this huge thing that's greater than us swoops in and takes that finishing season after, like, this buildup of taking a year off of competing. And yeah, so I can imagine that could have been incredibly heartbreaking. So how have you been handling all of the changes due to COVID-19?
Yeah, I guess when I immediately heard of it, I was really frustrated, just because I had started to have, like, I sort of came into more of a confidence where, like, I was actually having sort of more success and more happiness sort of with competing in that. And I remember we actually did a workout the day that we found out, because we weren't sure whether, like, the conference meets were going to be canceled yet. And I didn't care. Like, I just remember feeling so hopeless that, like, I kind of just, you know, for lack of a better word, just, like, half-assed it through the entire workout. And I think I didn't run for, like, 4 or 5 days after that. Just, like, wasn't at all happy about it. But I think, honestly, like, after about a week of it, like, I realized that I had almost 5 really great years of being a student athlete, and that in the grand scheme of things, like, that had been a success, and that, like, just because I didn't run this last outdoor season, it doesn't really, like, define me as a student athlete or define my experience. It was definitely really frustrating not getting to sort of define how it would end for myself. But I guess what our head track coach told me was, you know, everybody's athletic careers, everybody's collegiate athletic careers will come to an end, and you're never exactly sure when that's going to happen. You know, you could be injured or anything like that. And, you know, mine came to an end because of a global pandemic. And that was just the story, I guess. But honestly, like, I've really enjoyed the opportunity to sort of, like, reconnect with, like, my love for running for me, rather than just, like, running because, like, I'm part of a team or because, you know, everybody in the country is watching me be this person, this trans athlete.
So you just graduated college. It's so exciting. How are you looking to reinvent yourself as a runner post-college?
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of came about as a long, like, meditation, if you will. When I was going to quit before, like, the thought was, like, yeah, I'm just going to quit and I'm just going to run trails and be an ultra athlete. And yeah, I guess, like, for a long time this last year, like I was sort of thinking like I might try to dedicate myself to just training for ultra trail races, but sort of last minute, I applied for a graduate program last month here still at the University of Montana, and will be studying environmental philosophy. And I actually think that my experience as a trail runner, like a burgeoning trail runner, if you will be really complementary to what I study. And I think that is going to be like a really amazing way to sort of think about what I'm learning and sort of apply that while I'm out there and have like a relationship with sort of the mountains and the trails and everything else around me. And I'm actually really excited to be sort of pursuing that now and sort of learning about, I guess what I called it to some of the people in my graduate cohort was the eco-phenomenology of trail running, sort of like the being in environment of trail running and just thinking about that.
That's awesome. Just go out there on the trails and ponder the deep philosophical meaning to things while you're out there.
Yeah. Well, and I think like specifically with ultra races, like I guess I was talking before about like how I had a lot of time to think when I was in high school because I was training all the time by myself. I think ultra running is sort of like that to an extreme. Like you have a lot of time to think, and it'll be nice to sort of have these concepts and this relationship with sort of the environment that is positive for both of us, both me and the environment, I guess.
Do you see that in the future manifesting into any sort of, I don't know, like if environmental activism or climate justice type work?
Yeah, hopefully. Right now, like the thought is sort of all about like getting a really good paper together so I could potentially enter a PhD program and eventually be a professor somewhere. Because I think that'd be an awesome opportunity. And I really enjoy academia, which is, some people may be confused by that, but yeah. And I think that I'm hoping the trail running sort of takes me in the right direction with that stuff too. And you know, eventually if I do end up having some amount of success in it, like I think they'll be complementary. And like, if I have some amount of success in trail running, that would elevate my voice to be able to sort of spread it.
Yeah, trail running in itself is a powerful statement to make. And I really like that there aren't really times or standards per se to judge yourself off of as well. So my final question is, what is a piece of advice that you would tell to a younger version of yourself? And what is a message that you want to leave for a future version of yourself?
Yeah, I think for a younger version of myself, I'm thinking like when I was 12 and 13 years old, I probably would have been like, hey, like just, I think at this point I would just tell myself to just do it and see what happens. Just come out and it'll be better. Like, I couldn't have came out earlier. It's basically what I would have told a younger version of myself, just because I think that full experience of who I am as a person has been so valuable to me. And to like having a relationship with myself and, you know, liking myself, that I want that for younger me. And for older me, I think I would continue to ask myself like about those relationships, like my relationships with the environment and with the people around me, and to constantly reflect on those and make sure that, you know, both myself and those who I'm in relationships with are getting the best out of it and that those are positive. And I think that will hopefully leave a lasting mark.